All right. Okay. Hello, everybody. I am so excited to be here today at FOSDEM. This is actually my first ever FOSDEM. And I'm actually going to be giving a talk on an in-depth comparative analysis between the JVM and WebAssembly. So the question we're going to try and answer during this talk is, why did we create WebAssembly when we already have the JVM? If you think about it, with the JVM, we got this idea of, you know, write once, run everywhere. And now there's this new bytecode format called WebAssembly, and it's promising the same thing, write once, run everywhere. It actually calls itself a universal compilation target. So what we're really asking ourselves is, why do we need WebAssembly? And more specifically, what are the differences between the JVM and the WebAssembly virtual machine? If there really is value to WebAssembly over just using the JVM, what is it? So a little bit about me first. My name is Siobhan Shvij. I'm the founder of a startup called Loophole Labs. Those are my socials right there in case anybody wants to chat afterwards. And at Loophole Labs, we actually found a very compelling real-world use case for WebAssembly, which is what led to this talk. We work on a little project called Architect, which is mostly open source, and it's an orchestrator for live migrating stateful workloads like VMs or processes in user space between nodes, and we keep the network alive while we do it. So for example, there's a really famous Java application that everybody knows, Minecraft. So we could run a Minecraft server on an AWS VM, let's say in Frankfurt, and then we could connect to it from, let's say, Vancouver, and we could live migrate that Minecraft server to a GCP VM in New York, so across continents, between cloud providers, and you know, my Minecraft client in Vancouver would stay connected, you wouldn't see any dropped packets or lag, and in fact, because New York is closer to Vancouver than Frankfurt is, we'd actually see a lower latency. So people like to use us to run stateful workloads on spot instances in the cloud and, you know, avoid downtime for their on-premise servers whenever they have to bring them down for maintenance. All right, back to WebAssembly. What we found as we were building out Architect was that users really wanted to customize the way that it worked. They wanted to basically have a plugin system so they could bring their user-defined functions into our network stack, into our scheduling layer. And it turns out that WebAssembly is actually a very good way of achieving this. And so we wrote and open-sourced a project called Scale, which you can find right there at scale.sh. And it's a framework for adding WebAssembly plugin systems to your applications. WebAssembly provides a great sandboxing layer that we'll get into during this talk. And of course, that's very necessary when you're going to run untrusted user code, which is effectively what these plugins are. So let's talk about the JVM and WebAssembly. And to do that, we're going to start with a brief history lesson. In the beginning, we had the Big Bang. And then a bunch of stuff happened, and we came up with the JVM. And then a bunch more stuff happened, and we ended up creating WebAssembly. So let's start by filling in some of those gaps. Why did we create the JVM in the first place? And then why was it necessary to create WebAssembly after that? So in the beginning, there was the Big Bang. But if we actually start there, we'll be here for a while. So let's fast forward a bit to machine code. All software is presented to the CPU as native machine code, even today. Unfortunately, the readability of that machine code is extremely low. And the writability is even lower. So to make writing software somewhat practical, we invented assembly code. And the idea was actually quite simple. We assigned easy-to-remember names to each machine code operation. Like you can see here, we have add x, y, z, which really means add y and z and save it to x. And then we created an assembler to parse those instructions and assemble them into native machine code. Pretty cool, right? It seems like the perfect programming model, and it's how all software should be written for the rest of time, and why would we ever do anything else? Well, one reason you would do something different is that different processors, especially back then, had different assembly languages. And this is true even to some extent today. But back then, there was no global assembly language standard. And because different CPUs had different assembly code and therefore unique machine code, you had to rewrite your software each time you wanted to support a new CPU. So how do you solve this? Do you just magically create a global standard? Well, sort of, yeah. Just like assembly was effectively a layer of abstraction over machine code, what if there was a virtual CPU that had its own standardized dialect of machine code? So you could write software to target just that virtual CPU, and then you could translate that vCPU machine code to real CPU machine code. And of course, the name for this virtual bytecode format was the JVM bytecode. But how does the JVM bytecode actually work? Well, the point of the JVM bytecode was to allow it to run on any CPU. So right off the bat, it couldn't really make use of CPU-specific registers because, as the name implies, they're unique to specific GPUs, to specific CPUs. There are obviously some registers that you can rely on and are common, like the program counter and the frame register, but generally you want to avoid registers. So what do you do instead? You use a stack, and the idea is really simple. We'll store some stuff on the stack and then pop it off to consume it, and then we can run on any CPU that supports stacks. We just need an interpreter or a JIT or an AOT compiler, and that will actually spit out the native machine code. So this stack-based approach to bytecode is the reason that we can be CPU agnostic. And it's going to be important when we talk about WebAssembly's bytecode format as well. Great. So the JVM is born, except no one's actually going to write JVM bytecode by hand. There's going to be a higher order language called Java. And this is, of course, where Oracle steps in, takes responsibility for creating and maintaining actual CPU-specific JVMs, right, that translation layer, and everyone can just write their code in Java. And we all know how that turned out. OK, so now we have the JVM. It's important for us to understand some of these contextual decisions that led to the creation of the JVM. And now that we know that, we're going to actually refer back to these contextual decisions throughout the rest of this talk, especially as we start moving towards the WebAssembly end of this timeline. So now let's take it to the browser. At this point on the timeline, the internet is starting to take off. People are getting tired of static, flat websites. They want a little bit of sparkle. They want a little bit of interactivity on their websites, right? And so really what they're saying is, I want to write code that can run in your browser whenever you load up my website. So why not just use Java? Funnily enough, there actually was a JVM that could run in the browser at this point. And this is back, you know, in the Netscape era. But the problem was that the JVM couldn't interact with the DOM. It was really just a window or an element that would load in, slowly, I might add. The JVM was large and the internet was slow. And you could program what happened inside that element, but you couldn't really modify the rest of the website, at least, you know, not easily. So to solve this, we created JavaScript, or LiveScript back then. And the idea was the exact same, right? I have a higher order language that can run in a VM. This time, this VM ships with the browser, so I don't have to load it every time. And it was designed to be sandboxed and could actually interact with the DOM. Of course, it didn't have to be fast, because why would it have to be fast? The only thing people are ever going to use JavaScript for is to add a little bit of interactivity to a website, right? And again, you all know how that turned out. As the internet became popular, so did JavaScript. And websites began to rely more and more on it. Naturally, performance actually did start to become a concern. And the main issue, of course, is that JavaScript is not compiled to bytecode like Java. It's interpreted, though we've come a long way with JIT and AOT. You know, we have to acknowledge that. But even with that, JavaScript's features like the garbage collector don't map easily to CPU instructions. So what do we do? Well, the answer was actually a subset of JavaScript called ASMJS. And the premise was really simple. What if we wrote JavaScript that itself was performant? We could avoid heap allocations and so reduce garbage collector pressure. And then we could coerce our types in the source code itself so that the interpreter could skip having to generate and run type checks. Really, we just write JavaScript that was easy for the interpreter to optimize and just make it do less work. So here we have an example of an ASMJS function, right? It looks like JavaScript, albeit with some weird bitwise operations. It takes this foreign variable argument, which contains an external function that our code has access to, and then there's this heap variable, which is just a buffer allocated on the heap. In the function itself, we can see that there are bitwise operations. These are mostly used for type coercion, right? Like the bitwise OR0 operation, which guarantees that the start and end variables that are defined are in 32s. So we're telling the interpreter to ignore any type checks on those variables because we've coerced them in the source code. With the bitwise shift operations we see in the for loop, they're there to guarantee memory alignment of 8 bytes because float 64s are represented as 8 bytes. So we're adding these additional lines to tell the interpreter it can skip doing type checks and boundary validations and also avoid the garbage collector. And with that, we now have the historical context to get us to WebAssembly. At this point, right, we're not there at WebAssembly yet, we just have ASMJS. And at this point, mscripten exists and can take C and C++ code and spit out ASMJS for it. Unfortunately, that code is still JavaScript. It's not going to be anywhere near as fast as the C and C++ code that actually generated it. Moreover, these performance issues that we're starting to see only get worse as code bases get bigger. Then there's the issue of parse time. Larger code bases take longer to load and longer to parse. You have to remember that, you know, all of these pieces that we're talking about were designed to add interactivity to HTML, not build Figma. So what do we do? Right? Browser companies like Google, Microsoft, even Mozilla, right, they want to move beyond the limitations of ASMJS. They're saying, I don't want to generate JavaScript for my C and C++ code. I just want to run my C and C++ code in the browser. And this is where WebAssembly finally makes its debut, being able to run languages directly in the browser without any JavaScript involved. And that's where the name comes from as well. It's assembly, like x86, but for the web. And then we'll have a virtual machine inside the browser that can run said bytecode, a WebAssembly VM. So now let's define some key requirements based on kind of the problems that we've already seen. First, we're going to want this WebAssembly specification to have near-native performance, So we need a bytecode format because we can compile languages to it and kind of optimize during the compilation. We also need that format to be streamable. We don't want the user sitting there waiting for the download to finish before things start to process. We want to stream it in and start working on it right away. We also know that this VM is going to need to be stack-based, not just for compatibility, but for bytecode size. Again, that's something we learned from the JVM. Now, we specifically want a stack VM with structured control flow. We're going to dive into this in a few slides, but what that really means is that validation will be easier because the control flow is much stricter at the bytecode level. Okay, and then the last key requirement we have here is that we need sandboxing to be a first-class citizen. What this means is that the bytecode needs to be sandboxed but extendable. The browser should be able to provide foreign functions, similar to what we saw just now with ASMJS, which will get run outside the VM. We want to be able to do things like get the system time or make an HTTP request, but only if the browser gives us access. Okay, so we have all those requirements. Now let's look at the bytecode format itself. The most important thing to note is that it's represented as an abstract syntax tree. This provides us with a lot of benefits, like the fact that you can actually serialize ASTs very efficiently, which means smaller binaries, but also decode performance, so modules can start faster. Furthermore, streaming is built in as a property of ASTs, so we can start processing them as soon as they begin to stream in. We also want our format to be language agnostic, and the AST is designed for this too. It's abstract, so it's easier to map languages to it, not to mention the fact that optimizing an AST is simpler as well. Because we're loading in the module at runtime, we want to be able to quickly check whether it's valid. It turns out an AST by definition is structured, and we can add metadata to it to make validation extremely fast. We also want to be able to enforce structured control flows. And I'm going to talk about what this means in the next slide. But for now, all you need to remember is that an AST can represent a structured control flow very well. And that's something that we want. And finally, we have future flexibility. Normally, once you've baked in a bytecode format, that's that. Your VMs are grandfathered into that format. But by using an AST, we can take advantage of that abstraction, which gives us a little bit of flexibility in changing the syntax as we innovate in further adoption. Okay. Now let's actually look at the structured control flow. This is my favorite part of the WebAssembly bytecode format. The JVM uses something called unstructured control flow. When the JVM starts up, it loads all the Java classes, and then it has to verify them, basically check that the code is safe to run and complete. Let's say your code has a jump or branch instruction, like go to or if equals. We need to verify that you're jumping to somewhere that actually exists, or you're passing around variables that actually have the correct type. The bytecode does not encode this information directly. Instead, it uses stack maps. That's a modern improvement. And they're basically metadata that's stored somewhere else in the bytecode, because we couldn't go back and modify the original bytecode format. And the JVM uses that to do the validation in a single pass. Now, with WebAssembly, we want structured control flow instead of unstructured control flow. And specifically, what that means is we want proper structured contracts in our AST. I'll show an example of this in a moment, but instead of saying jump to this instruction that may or may not exist, the WebAssembly AST should have an if or an else statement right in the bytecode. Moreover, with WebAssembly, you shouldn't need to use if equals or go to operands to represent a loop. You should have a loop keyword right in the bytecode. Naturally, all this means that single pass validation is really simple, but also it's really easy to parse the control flow just from looking at the abstract syntax tree, which we're going to do in a second. Okay, so let's actually look at an example of this now. I have a very, very simple Java function here. It's a simple print function. And let's start by first looking at the JVM bytecode for this code, right? You can see that we have a couple different lines here, and we've skipped a couple of them. But on line one, right away, we do a unstructured jump to line 14. This is our, you know, if equals operation. And what we're really doing is we're saying, hey, if you're going to jump to line 14, that's, you know, we're going to print 0. That's our else statement from our Java code. Otherwise, we're going to, you know, continue onward to line 7, which is where we print 1. That was our if statement in our Java code, right? But these are unstructured jumps. So if that go to operand on line 11, for example, said go to 256, we'd need to somehow be able to check that line 256 actually exists and is valid to jump to, right? And so, you know, sometimes that can take multiple passes. Maybe the first pass to check what lines exist, and then the second pass to check who's calling what and what the branches are. And so, you know, that can require a couple of passes as things get more complex. And stack maps, you know, that the whole point of stack maps was to embed metadata into the bytecode format that we could use to amortize this cost. So now let's look at the equivalent WebAssembly here. And we're going to represent the AST in a text format called WAT. First, we can see that there's going to be some external function called log. That's part of that console namespace. And that function takes an I32 as a parameter. This is what lets us extend WebAssembly. So similar to what we saw with ASM.js, where you have, you know, that foreign variable, or, you know, with C header files and dynamic dispatch, you know, that's what these import variables are for. And then after that, we have this func0 defined, which takes an I32 as a local parameter and calls an if statement. And then there's also an else block. So it's really visually obvious exactly what the control flow is. And it matches up really cleanly to the Java code that generated this. So our bytecode is encoding the types and the control flow logic right in the AST, right at the binary, in the bytecode format, which makes it very easy to validate even as we start to just stream it in. Okay, so now that we understand structured control flow and the general WebAssembly bytecode format a little better, let's take a look back at the JVM and see exactly what WebAssembly is doing differently. Earlier in this talk, we looked at how the size of the JVM was a factor when JavaScript was created. And again, we decided that WebAssembly was necessary. The JVM is very opinionated on the shape of the languages that it can run. Specifically, you can't do things like opt out of memory management, which is necessary for languages like Rust or Zig. This goes back into that, you know, JVM footprint issue. It's great for Java developers, but not really for small C and C++ functions you want to run in the browser. When making new languages work on the JVM, you don't just need to figure out how to compile them for the JVM, but also somehow map them to the opinions and nuances of the JVM. So, okay, with all that in mind, what does the WebAssembly VM do differently? The key idea here is that the WebAssembly VM does as little as possible, and it does that by having no opinions. The question, you know, we're going to ask ourselves every time you're writing something is, what's the bare minimum required for this virtual machine to function? An example of this is memory management. The VM just gives your module a linear chunk of memory and says, do what you want. If we think back to our ASM.js example, that's really similar to the heap variable that the ASM.js function received. This approach is especially great for languages that manage their own memory, but there is a downside for languages that rely on a garbage collector, like Golang or Java. You know, now they have to bring their own garbage collector into the WASM module with them. It's obviously problematic and relatively wasteful, but there is a proposal that just got accepted that adds a common GC interface to the WebAssembly VM, and your language can just hook into it. So going back to what the WebAssembly VM doesn't provide, there's also no standard library. With the JVM, you have a bunch of JDK-provided functions, but with WebAssembly, there's just absolutely nothing. This reduces bloat, and the beauty of this is that WASM modules can be extremely small, bringing literally only what they need with them. In fact, there's barely any built-in types. There's not even a string type representation in WASM. Your language has to bring that itself. There's literally just four types available, right? There's I32s, I64s, Float32s, and Float64s. And then finally, there's this idea of imported host functions that we talked about, which makes the WebAssembly VM extremely easy and safe to extend. And that's exactly what WebAssembly is. Small but mighty, easy and safe to extend. We've compared all these nuanced differences, the various design decisions, and even the architectures of the VMs themselves, and in return, we get a browser-native VM that is designed to run as many languages as possible, as efficiently as possible. The WebAssembly VM can start extremely fast as modules are being streamed in the, you know, microsecond range instead of, you know, milliseconds or even seconds with something like Java. And you also don't need a lot of memory for each instance of the VM. Just a few kilobytes will do. And when it's time to clean up the VM, you just need to recover your linear memory chunk, and that's it. All of this, of course, makes it ideal for the browser, which is what we wanted in the first place, but now we can go further. Now that we have these capabilities, WebAssembly starts to look really interesting on the server side as well. In a world of serverless functions, fast starts and small footprints are key. And that's what we get here. There's also, of course, the idea of a plugin system where your application can act as that host, right, in place of the browser. And you can run user-defined functions and user-defined code safely alongside your existing business your business logic. And that's what we built our scale project for. With WASM, we actually have solved all the problems we set out to solve when we decided to build a, you know, a JVM that could run anything anywhere, right? We don't just have to ship the WASM VM to the browser anymore either. We can also just ship the WASM VM inside other apps so they can act, you know, they can have plugin systems. And with that, we can say that WebAssembly really is a universal compilation target. And that's it. That's our in-depth comparative analysis between the JVM and the WebAssembly VM. I know that's a lot of low-level information about bytecode formats and control flow, but I hope that everyone here can walk away understanding, at the very least, why WebAssembly is special, what problems it was trying to solve, as well as the historical context of some of the decisions that it makes. Thank you all so much for sticking with me until the end here. I'm happy to take any questions if we have time. We have time for one question.
The way you presented it, it's mostly related to the actual using the WASM in the browser. But isn't the speed of the DOM access still a problem?
So
the actual manipulation of the DOM, as far as I know, it's still slower a lot than doing it through JavaScript or something more.
Yes, absolutely.
Is there a way to solve it, maybe?
Is there a way to solve it? There's a couple of different ways. We've been kind of looking at this at Lupo as well. And the most obvious reason for the DOM access to be slow is it has to go from your WebAssembly VM out to JavaScript, which then triggers an action. If you could somehow interact directly with the browser, and you could interact with an API that maybe the browser exposed to manipulate the DOM, and that was available as a standard set of interfaces to the WebAssembly VM, that, I think, would be the most performant. Because at that point, you just have to optimize the host call performance, which you can actually get really, we do a benchmark at Loophole where like calling Rust from Go, you can do like in the sub microsecond range. Yeah. Okay. I think I'm out of time for questions. But if you guys want to chat some more, I'll be right outside.